All on the streets, the signs read cheaper, better technology. This capitalist division is my nightmare.
Hey, all right, this is Tim Crisp, and you're listening to Road to the Skeleton Coast with Brendan Kelly. Brendan, what's going on, Bubba? How are you?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm doing great. I am so looking forward to this. You see, we've had a couple nice, brisk conversations, and it was so cute to see you tweet about how exhausted you were after the first episode.
Yep.
And then you're falling asleep on me last week doing ghost stories.
That's right.
And then you say, oh, next week we're going to talk about Broken Star, which we did not discuss.
That's correct, yes.
The Lawrence Arms podcast that we were supposed to do, you just said, oh, let's turn it into Broadway's podcast too. But you know what? I had a good night's sleep, made myself a big cup of coffee.
All right.
This morning, and I'm excited to talk about the only Broadway's record, because we are going to have so much to talk about.
All right.
Amazing.
I mean, there was another Broadway's record.
That's true. That's true. And we are going to talk about Broken Van as well. So I thought it would be helpful for this week to just say at the top of the show that we're going to talk about Broken Star, and we're going to talk about it as a record, and we're going to maybe save Broken Van for a little bit more of the sort of Broadway's lore stories and things like that.
Sure.
So anybody here who's banking on getting all of the Broadway's information into this single episode, fret not. We'll come back to it.
It's great. That one guy out there that's banking on that.
I think that there are like 11.
Yeah, there might be like 11.
Well, we're thankful for those 11 and for all of our future listeners. Again, we are recording these all a little bit in advance. So by the time this goes up, we will, you know, probably all feel like family, all of our future listeners out there. I really can't wait to just, you know, be so close to all of you. And we thank you for joining and for rating and subscribing and telling all your friends on the internet about our podcast. As Brendan knows, I am at Better Yet. He doesn't follow me on Twitter, but we're friends. And he told me he's going to. He's at Bad Sandwich. So, Broken Star, the single Broadway's LP,
yes,
was released on January 23rd, 1998, and that would be the third of eventual 13 weeks at number one for the movie Titanic.
There, it's no coincidence.
The talk that I was hearing from all of my fellow fourth grade friends,
yeah,
was that there were boobs in that movie.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, and there's, you know, four boobs in the Broadways, too. So, there you go.
So we got the first Broadway's record, graciously released by Asian Man Records.
Yes.
And you are all probably thinking, oh, slapstick fans are going to be so stoked about this new band featuring Brendan the singer and Dan the trumpet player.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting because there definitely was an element of that. You know, when we started the Broadways, when I was in slapstick, that just happened so fast. It was like a lightning in the bottle kind of thing. And, you know, now in hindsight, I can see that like the collection of people that came together to be slapstick was like a real, it's like a who's who of my favorite musicians, really. And like, those guys are all so talented. I mean, like, with the exception of myself, those guys are all brilliant. But you know, like I was like the singer in that band, and I did have it in my head that like it's just this easy. And now like I have like proved myself on like a national stage or whatever, and this band is so much cooler, and we're just gonna, yeah, it's gonna be the exact same thing.
And if anything, you know that fans of slapstick are really, they're just there for you. They're not there for the fact that you're a ska punk band.
That is correct. Yeah. I mean, so, which, if only it were so easy. In reality, you know, it's the late 90s was really interesting in terms of punk rock, underground music, whatever you want to call it. It was very very singular. So it was like there, everything was pop punk, and then everything was ska punk. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, later on, everything became emo, and then everything became like the pop punk revival and sure. like that kind of thing. You know, so what I did not count on when we formed the Broadways was that everybody was still on the ska punk thing, and it just didn't matter what you did. Mm-hmm. Even if we had been a much better band, there's just no getting through that at that time. Like, yeah. it just wasn't what people wanted to hear. And, you know, this is a thing that, interestingly enough, would go on to plague me throughout my career. But, you know, I liken it to, you know, it's just everything's so ahead of its time, Tim. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I mean, we're still figuring it out. How you just knew at that age, at 15 years old, it's the perfect time for ska. And then, I mean, we're still trying to understand the insights that you had into dropping off of the ska thing. So, you know, just in its prime. Yeah, I get it. But, I mean, obviously, that you're 18 years old. And you're in one band, and that band blew up.
Right.
What insights are you supposed to have about musical trends and about how shit works
totally.
That would make you think anything other than that?
Yeah, totally. And also, like, it's just, like, the Broadways is a classic example of, like, a bunch of first-year sociology students. You know what I mean? It's like,
totally.
All of a sudden, we're doing really important work, and it's like, oh, you don't get it, man? and you know, in hindsight, it's pretty hilarious. I mean, this record's so ahead of its time, no one still likes it yet. We're still waiting on that period.
Come on. I mean, no, seriously. It's absolutely seen its renaissance. If anything, we're past the renaissance. So now we're back to, I don't care about it, but I'm sorry. Matt Einstein Allison records it at Alice Studio. That's a very respectful nickname that you have for Matt there.
Well, that was that nickname is based on the fact that that old Atlas was above an Einstein bagel, and he would eat there like three meals a day every day, and he also would sleep on the couch in the studio. And then Matt Allison used to be notoriously late, and we showed up for this session, as for the ones we did, and for our 7 inches, which came out before this, and we'd show up at, you know, he'd be like, let's get started at 11, and he would open the door to clearly having just woken up, and he'd be like, sorry, I just came in the back door, and there's no back door. Like, the whole thing was hilarious. But
so how quickly was this recorded then?
This was recorded in 2 days, I think.
Yeah,
I think it was recorded and mixed in 2 days.
I will say that this has, for 2 days, this sounds great. I think that the performances they're a little sloppy, but they're really, really tight.
Yeah, I mean, I think the nature of the way the band functioned also was just the makeup of our band. Like, Dan plays like really angular guitar stuff, and mm-hmm. Chris plays that more like full chord, like washy thing. That those two things don't necessarily marry all the time in terms of like a tight cohesive sound, but I mean, it's really interesting, the mm-hmm. dynamic. And then, you know, Rob was like, he had this vision of being like the most innovative drummer of all time. Like, mm-hmm. he would really say that. He'd be like, the drums I'm gonna do on this record are going to be like nothing anyone's ever heard. And that's very true. I mean, he does a lot of like really innovative stuff on there. And, but there was, everybody was kind of thinking that way. You know what I mean? And
so
there was no thought of the whole.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And yeah, I'm glad that we established like early on that we have Dan's guitar playing a lot of like the octave stuff. And then you hear Chris's stuff, because I think, yeah, both of those make a really cool marriage. This is also a really cool record to listen to, and I'll point out a few spots on it, but listening to Chris play guitar on this record, he's using a tone that you're never going to really hear again. It's a pretty interesting thing to take and then look into, like, once the Lawrence arms start, you can't hear some of these sounds like coming out of Chris's guitar ever.
Right, right.
So the Broadways, and this is like the one thing that I really wanted to hit on that is a little bit more cursory, but it's in the liner notes. The Broadways and Bicycle Records address is 1729 West Albion, Albion House, if you've lived in the city of Chicago in the past 30 years. So this house, up until honestly like 18 months ago, was still having shows. This is a very legendary punk house.
I think it still has shows.
I think that they just ended. There was a incident involving a broken jaw on a baseball bat from what I hear. But I've seen a number of shows at this place over a long span of time. I saw the band Tenement here probably 7 times or something like that. But Dan was living at that house.
Yeah, Dan. The original lineup of the Albion House was Dan is the one who found the house. Like it was not a punk house before that. Like it was our crew that like did all that stuff, and Dan being kind of like the mastermind of that. Dan found the house. He lived there with Chris. And Sean Obrey, who's a just good buddy of ours, and Danny from the Alkaline Trio lived there for a while too.
It's awesome, and it just kept getting passed down. Mm-hmm. I've never seen above the basement of that place, so I'm kind of interested to see like what the corners of that house look like after 25 years or whatever.
Yeah.
I did see Dan yesterday. Wow. Dan Hanaway. I was getting coffee with my friend Pat, and Dan was leaving his restaurant, Ground Control, in Logan Square. It's the best vegan restaurant in the city.
Excellent restaurant.
I know a lot of people come into town, they want Chicago Diner, but Ground Control is far superior.
I try to send everybody that says they're going to Chicago Diner, I say, just go to Ground Control instead.
It's a pretty nice ad read we did there.
Yeah.
We should try and get a couple of those. But this is the year 1998. No sellouts allowed.
No.
And during this time.
No.
So let's get into it. 15 minutes, first song on the record. I don't think I've ever had a time in my life when this wasn't my favorite song on this record. It's such a fucking great opening track.
It's I mean, just like everything about it is cool, I think. Dan really kind of killed it with this one. He I remember just the end, just like when he like did like that, I'm not crazy, just frustrated, and we were all like, oh wow. And you know, it was those kind of moments that made us be like, well, this band is going to be huge.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely. We're
gonna be fine. Like, never mind that like everything's just like modulated, like just a little bit flat or sharp, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that, like, I mean, definitely there's not a lot of like artful vocal delivery on this record, but I you know, of all these songs, this one holds up the best, I think.
It's hard to imagine it like anywhere else, even like in a show. Like the idea that you're playing 15 minutes anywhere other than the first song that you play in the set.
Well, the Lawrence Arms used to cover this song.
Really?
We did when we did that tour, we called it the Taco Bell tour because it was all just the same four ingredients repurposed in different ways.
Oh, so we're doing Lawrence Arms Falcon Sundowner.
Yeah, uh-huh. And we covered on that tour a slapstick song, and we covered 15 minutes.
That's awesome.
Just to kind of, I mean, at the time, it was like my wife was just pregnant. We didn't know if we were going to have much more of a career after that. You know, like we were coming off of O Calcutta. We were afraid, I think, at least I was, of like the huge like shadow that cast. You know, like that record was, it really changed everything for us.
Yeah. You know? In like a, how the fuck do we follow this?
Yeah. And I just felt like it had turned out really, really well. And so like, I wasn't ready to write new music for the Lawrence Arms.
Yeah, I could see that.
And also, that was the same year that Unicornography came out.
Mm-hmm.
So there's probably a large percentage of people that would say those are the two best records I ever wrote. And they came out like within 10 months.
Right.
You know, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Within 6 months even. So like, we didn't really know how to proceed with what was going to happen. You know, I was going to be a dad. that's fucking weird.
Yeah.
And
was the, and we obviously don't have to get into it, but where does the audit come in? Is that?
That was right after that tour.
Mm-hmm.
It had a lot to do with the fact that we went from, like, we were still trying to operate with the same methodology that we'd employed since we were kids making no money. And once all of a sudden we're making money and we're like touring on a bus, you know, the numbers just jump out and it's just like a red flag.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, the whole thing ended up being fine. And I would urge people not to be terrified and start binge drinking at like 10 in the morning out of fear. But I can't say that to my former self. So anyway, we covered 15 minutes because mm-hmm. I think we wanted to do like something, at least I did, that was like really like a fans like completionist evening. That's why it was Sundowner, the Falcon, the Lawrence mm-hmm. Arms. And then, you know, when it came to the idea of doing Broadway's and a slapstick song, the choices were just really obvious. And it's like, there's no way we're not doing 15 minutes. And, you know, the good thing about that is 15 minutes finally played tight and in tune. First time ever.
And for lunch, we'll have Big Macs. Everything I ever wanted to learn about genocide, I learned in the third grade. It's become a tradition. Every Thanksgiving, someone on my timeline posts the pageant scene from Adam's Family Values, and someone else posts a video to this.
Yeah, this one, I mean, this is a great example of, like, sociology 101 or whatever, but, mm-hmm. I mean, like, it's a little bit earnest, but it is supposed to be funny. That's the thing that I don't think people understand about this song.
Yeah, yeah.
Is
yeah.
that, like, this is kind of what we were talking about last week, about having a sense of humor, and it's like, I mean, this the song is sincere, it's serious, mm-hmm. and I agree with the sentiment of it, but it was supposed to be over the top and hilarious as well, you know. And for that reason alone, this is probably my favorite of my Broadway songs.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because most of my songs are pretty bad on this. We've talked about this before on your other podcast.
Oh, Better Yet?
Yes.
Did you forget the name of my other podcast?
I did. no, but I'm just kidding. I never knew it. But the thing is, like, this one, we just had so much fun writing. I have other songs of mine that I like more on the Broken Van record, on the mm-hmm. old 7 inches.
Yeah.
But by the time this came along, what really was happening, and I think Chris would say the same thing, was that Dan was just writing so many awesome songs that it was like being up against the ropes, like, mm-hmm. you know, like against a prize fighter. Like every time he'd bring in a song, it was like, oh shit, that's so good. And it just like ate away at our confidence and ability to write songs, I think, as well as we possibly could have. But some of these early on ones, like this one and then Kitchen Floor, which is Chris's next one, those mm-hmm. two are good. But after that,
so good, yeah.
After that, it really started to become obvious that it was like we were just trying to play catch up with Dan because he was mm-hmm. just such a visionary at the time. And so, but with this song, like the end part, is really the funniest part. Like the Australia is a piece of shit floating in the Pacific.
That's the cue. Like that's the really hard cue. Earlier in the song, when you're talking about like explaining, getting your mom to admit that a race is a killing machine, it's like, no, there's no way he's seriously saying that. But then the Australian thing, it's like, wait, what?
But that, and I mean, also like, if I have my way, we'd all dress in black and Daddy would serve up the white meat. Yeah. Dude, we were dying laughing. And then when we got to the end of it, like we didn't know how to end it. And then all of a sudden, we're just like, what if we just like turned into like a goofy ass shuffle where she's like, boo by the blood and aborigine. And then like make it like super dancey. And we were like, I mean, when we were putting this song together, we were crying laughing. And again, it's a serious song. The topic is something I still believe in and back. And like,
mm-hmm.
for being like a sort of like punk 101 kind of thing to get you into like more thoughtful political punk bands.
It's a perfect subject.
It does it, you know. And but yeah, that's the salient point here, is that this song is funny.
So, like, genuine question: you have kids,
yes.
So when they're in third grade, mm-hmm. like, what are you talking to them about when it's Thanksgiving time? Like, obviously, when they're in the like, you know, hand trace, like turkey phase, you're not sitting them down and saying like, listen, your teachers are lying to you about the first Thanksgiving.
Right, right. Well, the thing is, this song was never intended to be an indoctrination for parents to talk to their third grade children.
I'm interested in just like in that part of your life now.
My kids are very aware of the fact that America in general is, you know, built on the blood of the disenfranchised. And that's not to say that I like try to force it down their throats or anything, but mm-hmm. you know, they'd be the first people to laugh in your face if you said that pilgrims and Indians were homies.
Yeah, yeah. For sure.
You know,
for sure. Yeah, as you mentioned, Kitchen Floor, it's a fucking perfect Chris song. The difference is that you kind of lump him in where Dan is clearly outshining him, but he has a lot more great songs on this record.
Well,
I don't know about you necessarily, but like this one, it's so fucking perfect. Was he really that out of control? Like,
yeah. Oh, we played this song too, actually.
Oh, cool.
The Lawrence Arms, we played this song as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's kind of the same thing. It's like, but this is really a very early, like primordial Lawrence Arms song.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, and I think that, yeah, I mean, we were all kind of out of control, you know, and that this is, to the best of my memory, based on a true story, where he did wake up in the morning on the kitchen floor.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, that's not that out of control. At least it's the kitchen, his house.
Right.
You know?
Totally.
Albion house, actually.
It's absolutely like Chris goes on to write this song and you go on to kind of write this type of song too. It's funny the way like it sits on this record where like Chris has like a couple of like political lines on here, but really it's just Chris writing Chris songs.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to it later, but there's only three songs here that Chris sings,
mm-hmm.
and one of them was written by Sean Nader.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting into that one.
Co-written.
Yeah.
I mean,
shout out to my friend Mike Nauer. The Kitchen Floor has been like his handle for everything since the beginning of time. Police Song. Do you know the story of Dan's friend here?
That is Chris singing that.
Verse. Oh, okay.
And I believe that was Sean O'Bray, who was the other guy that lived at the Albion House. And back then, that neighborhood was weird, and I think he was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Kind of, I think maybe he had weed on him or something. And all I know is he got his ass kicked by the cops.
Mm-hmm.
And they, I don't think, arrested him. Or maybe they did arrest him, charge him with resisting arrest. It was a very weird, convoluted thing, and... But yeah, it was something that was just going on at the time, and then there was that Operation Broken Star was going on right mm-hmm. then, which was a sort of internal investigation into the police force to root out corruption like that, and the failure to report things, so the city's crime statistics seemed better than they were,
mm-hmm.
which was so it's something that still goes on.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought they figured it out. I thought the Chicago police
leave it. Yeah, they're you're right. They're on the straight and narrow now. I mean, when Toby got mugged, I believe the cops showed up and he got mugged at gunpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Called the police and they're like, "Hey, we don't see anybody here. How do we know you had a wallet?"
Jesus Christ. Yeah, I was gonna ask about like Broken Star, what that meant, but it was kind of like a like citywide investigation into
police corruption. Yeah, mm-hmm. And you know, a lot of these songs. I mean, as an 18-year-old group of boys that want to be political, who is the first person to rail against is the cop, right?
Yeah, you know, yeah,
so,
for sure.
So it's just like the, I mean, all of these are railing against authority of some kind, but like there is just a heavy notion of fuck the police, as it were.
Yeah, totally. I was talking to my friend Todd Beamer, and he said that like this is kind of the first thing that really personalized, like the police are bad in a way that he's, you know, he's my age, so he's 13 or 14 and he hears it, and it's just like the first thing that just ingrains itself in a way that's more personal.
Right. Well, that's cool. Yeah, I mean, like I like this song. I feel like the bridge in this song is really the instrumental interlude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
is really interesting, and it's like one of the first times I played like a actual bass line, like mm-hmm. a cool bass line. So
who were you, like, I guess who are the bass players for you that like really made I don't know, just like put a template down for you? Did you have anybody in particular?
No, yeah, not really. Sure. I like the thing is, like, I've always been of the theory that like if you're really noticing the bass, it's probably because they're bad. Because mm-hmm. they're overplaying, or because they suck, you know.
And, yeah, yeah.
And I mean, like, I've done both in my life. But I guess like I always liked the sort of like the strummy bass of late '90s alternative, even though that wasn't really my style of music.
Mm-hmm.
But like stuff like your like Ned's Atomic Dustbin and stuff like that, where they're like literally like playing chords on the bass.
Yeah,
that was something that was like really big and influential to me. The early Jawbreaker stuff was like that as well.
Oh yeah, for sure.
You know, and I kind of took that coming as a sort of failed guitar player into a bass player. It just seemed like really like a natural way to be able to do things. And I would like write a lot of like riffs like that on mm-hmm. the bass that involved like multiple, like strumming multiple strings.
Upton B, I like making this jump that we did from Ghost Stories into Broken Star, because I think what we hit on last week is you doing a really good job of balancing, like talking about what's around you and your internalization of it in a really compelling way. And I like this song because this is where you're kind of actively involved in what's happening. To me, like, this is kind of the best writing that you do lyrically on this record.
Yeah, this one's got like a cool line in it, I think, at the very end, the one about prisons. That's kind of a cool lyric, I think. The mm-hmm. there's two kinds of prisons thing. Song itself is like, this is classic like Gilman 90s East Bay punk rock, where there's just no chorus. Mm-hmm. It's just like pretty melodic, but it never kicks into anything, you know. And I don't know, this one is one of those ones that's like sort of
so this is the 15, this is the Crimpshire.
Yeah.
Like, so like I've been trying to make sense of 15 like for most of my life.
Sure.
And I've been listening to them more since we started doing this, but like, what's your favorite 15 record? What's a good 15 record that...
Buzz.
Buzz?
Cool. Buzz is the best.
Mm-hmm. Everything, they're one of those bands that's just so hard to figure out like what's going on, because there's so many releases, mm-hmm. and now that it's like we're in the phase where things are re-released at different times, it's just like, it feels like so much work.
Yeah, yeah, and you know what? I mean, I don't know how much that stuff really holds up. It's a very much like the Broadways. It's very sloppy and very like sort of dissonant, and not like in a Fugazi kind of way.
Yeah,
more,
yeah.
More like in a we only had one, we had an hour to track all these vocals kind of mm-hmm. way, you know. And mm-hmm. And so I don't know how much I could imagine anybody getting into 15 right now as a adult consumer of music, you know, like
sure.
as a idealistic 16-year-old kid, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I can totally see it. But I'm not I'm not trying to make anyone listen to 15, I guess, is what I'm saying. But
well, I'd like to. I got some stuff to do today.
Yeah, Buzz is good. No Place Like Home, Goodnight's pretty good, too.
So is this...
Surprise. Surprise is good.
Is this a true story?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I used to spend a lot of time hanging out with, like, there's a large homeless population, like, in my neighborhood and near my school. And I just always would hang out with those dudes. I mean, I was, I guess, being like a punk kid.
Mm-hmm.
They would talk to me a lot, you know?
Because you look weird enough?
Yeah, sure. And so I just, like, kind of struck up a rapport with a lot of those, mostly dudes. And, you know, it sort of gave me, like, a bit of an affinity towards the plight of the homeless. And then, and that was something that was, like, a really big deal in, like, slapstick. That we had songs about that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Dan started a Food Not Bombs chapter, which serves dumpstered prepared food to homeless people in parks, right? Actually, there's a song on this record about Dan's Food Not Bombs chapter.
Oh, nice. Yeah, it's... are you living in the Lawrence Arms yet? I love that sentence. Are you living in the Lawrence Arms yet?
Let me think.
If not this year, within the next couple of years.
Yeah, no, I was living in an apartment with my girlfriend at the time.
Oh, is this the Red Line?
Yes, girlfriend? Yes, yes.
Oh, I can't wait to talk about that. Yeah, this is a really good time to talk about this, because Broadway in Lawrence is in Uptown. So Chris references Uptown in Your Gravest Words. So for people outside of Chicago, Uptown, it's a little bit north of Wrigley Field. It has a long and continuing history of being affected by reductions in federal funding. So during the 1960s and 70s, mental health care in the United States was being deinstitutionalized. So psychiatric hospitals were replaced by, like, these kind of community-based clinics, and there's a lot of those up in Uptown now, but there's also a long history of people who have just been, like, dispossessed because of that process. So Uptown, yeah, in particular, there's just a lot of people who just, like, kind of fell out as things were getting shaken around up there.
Yeah, there's a lot of, there was a huge influx of people that were determined to have mental illness issues and, mm-hmm, you know, like, we're, as you said, going from institutions to basically just to Uptown.
Yeah.
You know, and
well, there was a thing too where they converted a lot of, like, old apartments into low income housing, like, specifically for, mm-hmm, these people, but even still, like, not everybody, like, made it into those places.
Right, exactly. And at that same time, interestingly enough, when coal mining was going out of business, they just, like, loaded up whole towns in western Pennsylvania, just got them on Greyhounds, dropped them off in Uptown.
Wow.
And that's why Uptown, like, you know, like, we had neighbors who had chickens.
Uh-huh.
And like, there used to be, what they used to call it? It was, like Little Nashville, like, you know,
mm-hmm,
honky-tonk neighborhood or some shit.
Yeah.
It had, like, country western live music bars on, like, every corner.
Mm-hmm.
Now I think there's only one left, but
it's interesting because it's like it obviously affects your writing in so many ways. Here you have something that's more of just, like, kind of reporting, and then when you look into, like, guided tour and ghost stories, this, like, feeling of, like, these people that are just around you constantly.
Yeah, I mean, it is like a, that was the community that we lived in, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, it's pretty hard to divorce yourself from that, even if you want to, but we were all, like, conscientious enough dudes to, mm-hmm, not want to, you know? So yeah. It's, I mean, it seeps in for sure.
You think that's kind of where you seem to just have a way of just, like, kind of, like, jawjacking with literally anybody. So you think that's, like, I mean, you have to kind of, If people are approaching you a lot and you're receptive to that, you're getting pretty good at just talking to anybody about anything. Am I right?
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, I've never really analyzed it like that before, but it's quite possible. I've definitely had a lot of weird conversations with a lot of weird people in Uptown. Say that for sure.
Here, you also have Chris, reading a book for you. That's Salman Rushdie from last week.
Yeah.
We got a passage from Midnight's Children. Why Midnight's Children? Why this passage?
Well, Midnight's Children, make a long story short, is about the independence of India. And, I mean, it's a community facing serious growing pains. I mean, if you just want to, like, boil it down to, like, the simplest
All we need. Small connection that I'd like to make. We brought up Chris's citation of Don DeLillo's Mao 2. Chris has said that DeLillo has said that that novel was partially inspired by Salman Rushdie's Satanic Verses, and the political fallout and the assassination attempt on Salman Rushdie for the Satanic Verses. So if anyone out there has the same setup that I have in my living room, you can put a piece of string between those two thumbtacks, the footnote number 2 from Firefly's connection to Midnight's Children at the end of
Upton.
What's the name of it? Yeah, Upton, right.
name for Upton Sinclair.
Oh.
Yeah.
Makes a lot of sense. Oil, right? I never read it.
Well, he did that, but he did The Jungle, which
The
was...
Jungle, that's the one that's about Chicago, right?
Yeah.
Restless. You know what? Crazy thing. This is the song that I remember. Actually, there is something that I like more than 15 minutes, and that's this song, Restless.
Interesting.
I love this song. It's one that, like, it can pass you by, I think, but when you're kind of keyed into the story that he's telling and all of it, it hits so fucking perfectly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think this song's very meandering.
Yeah.
Like,
well, I mean, I think that criticism goes for a lot of songs on these.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. For sure. I can't remember. There's some part in this song that I like a lot. I can't think what it is right now.
It's just such a lovely story. Like, I fell asleep on the side of a mountain and I woke up to a peaceful morning. Fucking Hemingway over here.
You know what it was? What it is there's one guitar part. It's on do 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 do. I play that on the bass to warm up all the time. That's what I'm thinking of. That's a Dan Hanaway part, as pretty much all the really iconic guitar parts on this record.
Man, his playing on this record is so fucking good.
Yeah, he does a lot of really interesting stuff.
Jonathan Kozol was right. Jonathan Kozol is a writer and multicultural education advocate. He's written a number of books on the American public school system. Was this Savage Inequalities that you'd read?
Yes, yes, yes.
Where'd you read the book? Was it Sociology 101?
Yeah, I believe it was, actually. Actually, I like this song. It's fast and it's punchy and, like, I mean, it's pretty obvious, but I don't think there's anything... There's not a lot of my content on here that's not very obvious. So, but this one was not supposed to be funny. This one was based very much on, like, I mean, a lot of the lines in here come from, like, different documentaries I had watched, stuff that had stuck with me. Like that whole thing at the end, like, we're flowers growing in a garbage can.
Yeah.
That was a public school teacher on a documentary I saw. She was crying.
Wow.
While she was saying this. And I was just like, you know, and they asked me how come there's no books or how come we're, like, learning in the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
She says, we're flowers. We're just growing in a garbage can. But she's, like, fully in tears. You know, it was very moving to me.
Yeah.
And to be exposed to all of these things at the same time while living in Chicago. And, you know, Savage Inequalities is about the public school system in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't realize that. I thought it was about Boston, but...
Oh, maybe it is. I don't know.
He's from Boston. I personal story here. I was an education major when I was in college up until the very end when I was just like, fuck it, just take an English degree and get me out of here. And my roommate at the time was a social work major, and the flowers in the garbage can was sort of the thing that we came together on with just like both of our views on you know, teaching, and also his wanting to go into social work, like, within the school system. Like, that was, it's your best lyric on this, but it was also like a real like piece of, like, guiding just light for what we wanted to do when we cared.
Right back then. Another funny thing in this song is that the very end is the riff from Showdown by Propaganda.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we just play it one time. Just ding, 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 boom.
Oh.
But that's what it would sound like if it was played by people playing too fast for their fingers.
We'll have a party. It's a dance song. It's a pretty good song.
This one is huge. Yeah. I mean, this is the main song on the record. I mean,
you think so?
15 minutes is like the sort of mission statement. This is like the big grand centerpiece for sure. I think Dan's voice is not that good in this song, but it doesn't really matter because it's just so like emotional.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like so like, I mean, those opening like long held out notes that he does are flat, you know. I mean, mm-hmm. it's just, it sounds kind of like a little dopey too maybe, but it's almost, it doesn't really matter. Like it's so, there's one, I remember my girlfriend at the time, mm-hmm. Sitting next to me in the studio when Dan was singing this, and he did, you know, got a lot of nothing, taking all my time. And she was like burst into tears, you know?
Wow.
it was like, at the time, I just don't know if I'd ever heard anything really like this before,
yeah.
You know? And then the instrumental part is so cool in this.
Mm-hmm.
But this is like, again, another example of Dan just like being like light years ahead of all of us and of his time in general.
I think the big distinction for at least like lyrically with what Dan does on this record and what you do on here is that he really finds a way to just like put the lived in experience of like, I go to work just like everybody else and like here's everything that's fucking us, and yours is a little bit more like, let me explain this thing to you.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's totally, I feel like this is the way you're talking about what Dan's doing here versus what you're doing. If, and you've mentioned that like the feeling of like trying to compete with Dan or like catch up to Dan, it does seem like you're not super comfortable with like communicating the political message, even if like you want to. It's just like something that you're trying on that's not really meant for you. Would you say?
I think that it was more like I went to Northwestern, and so I was like reading a lot of books, and uh-huh. I was like getting a lot of information from like lectures.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? And so like that was coloring the way I tried to write things, and I'm getting away from that was proved to be very good for me, but at the time, again, it's just like you excrete what you consume.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
there's not enough Simpsons in this.
That is true.
Oh, this is, I forgot, this is the part where we open up the brand new segment, which is the one where I get to ask you a lingering question from last week. Who's your favorite non-Simpsons character?
Mr. Burns. There's no who else? Who's saying anything but Mr. Burns?
Skinner's
pretty
I
good.
I love Seymour Skinner.
I love Seymour Skinner too. But I mean, pish posh. That's what I.
He's perfect. He's perfect. So this is it's kind of one of the questions that I've been preparing for since even I'd say even like before you agreed to do this podcast, but like. Red Line B, you know, it does have like such a lived in experience. I want to know, like, sounds like you got your heart broken. I want to know if you're doing okay.
I'm okay. I've somehow recovered, but yeah, no, this is about a girl that I lived with. She was cool. I'm still friendly with her. She's a, but yeah, I liked her a lot.
Yeah, sounds like
it. She liked someone else at the end, and it was sad. But I mean, the song is like sappy and like I think kind of cheese dicky. But
did you?
It's because it came from a place of too much sincerity.
Yeah. The end, you say, "I'll never meet another like you." Did you Did you find someone else?
Oh, you know, there's so many girls just like her. It was crazy to think. I'm just kidding. Yeah, no, I managed to turn it around. But
I hear things are just as bad down in Lake Erie. Everybody's on this one.
Yep. Yep.
So where does it start? Who has the pieces of it? Who's got the?
I pretty much like wrote. I think I wrote all the lyrics. I wrote this whole song.
Uh huh.
I just wanted all of us to sing it.
Yeah.
And this is another one that's supposed to be funny, but it's a little less obvious this time. It's just like, yeah. I mean, this one's kind of like big and overblown. I guess I like the idea of it. You know, this is just a. Sort of a catch-all for like everything's very bad.
Yeah, totally. But it is like it's you checking your privilege before checking your privilege like was a thing,
right?
But yeah, it's I'm just scrolling through the lyrics and there's fucking like 19 stanzas to this.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy.
Fuck you, Larry
Cochet. That's what makes the title so good.
Who's Larry Cochet?
Larry Cochet was an authority figure that stopped Dan from doing Food Not Bombs. I don't remember. I think he owned a grocery store and Dan would like get the still good fresh food out of the dumpsters and the guy locked it up so he couldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
I believe is the story, but I might be wrong about that. But he was a guy that prevented Dan from being able to do Food Not Bombs for really no good reason.
Yeah. That's just fucking gross. There was that big Borders in Uptown that closed.
Yep.
And they just threw the books away.
Yeah.
They couldn't think of like a place to give them to. Shit like that. It's just like, you can't even, like just in the tiniest bit, do something for other people. Yeah. You know what's fucked up though is that actually, I think this is my favorite song on the record. If we're...
This is your third favorite.
I love this song.
Yeah, this song is cool. This is another one where Dan just came in and we were like, what the fuck? And this has got that, you know, we were talking last week about the end of Ghost Stories, the end of the last one on Ghost Stories and where it came from. And this has that in the beginning.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? And it's just like that, it's just kind of like that heavy meandering thing that was like really popular in the 90s. It occurs a few times on this record, I guess. There's a lot of instrumental parts. But I think like a heavy instrumental interlude is a different thing than like what's going on at the beginning of this
song. Yeah, totally. The intro, it reminds me a lot of the band John Brown Battery from the western suburbs of Chicago. They're a couple years later in like the 2000-2001. Did you ever play with them with the Lawrence Arms?
I think the Broadway's played with them. I think Lawrence Arms played with them. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that similar like kind of quiet music that like turns into a driving thing. They do a lot more like tempo shifts, but that's very much like what's in this song. And this is another one for people to just listen to Chris's guitar on this one. It's so clean compared to everything else, and there's like a lot of like kind of punchy reverb on it that you never really
see. That makes me think that you're thinking of Dan's guitar.
No, because Dan's got all of those like octave like leads, and Chris is playing a lot of like chords, but there's just like a clean tone on it that I think is.
Well, Dan plays clean on a lot of this. I mean, I'm not trying to argue with you, but Chris plays a lot of octaves on this record as well.
Oh, okay.
You know, so I honestly don't know. They both do a lot of weird stuff on here. I mean, like,
it is like two different guitar players kind of playing the same thing, and like
kind of playing the same thing.
It's don't listen too closely though, like the 2.5 minute part, because you come in with the like most awful like chord hits ever. It's like you're punching the pickups, dude.
Well, you know, That's that Ned's Atomic Dustbin strumming bass thing that I was talking about.
Yeah, you learn to do it a little bit cleaner later on down the line.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, no, I'm not the highlight of this song for sure. But what are you gonna do?
Here's what rules about this record for me. Like, I think more than anything else is that this is a record where you have three people all separately expressing the desire to get out of the place that they're in. It's the most 18-year-old thing ever.
Oh, yeah.
Is the desire to fucking leave the place you grew up and also, like, to fuck. Those are the two, yes, like, most pure 18-year-old desires, yes, in the world. It's kind of awesome because, like, you are people from the city. You describe yourself as, like, a townie.
Yeah.
So the idea that that sentiment is coming from a place like Chicago, as opposed to, like, I got to get out of my small town,
right,
which is what we're all more used to, or, like, your super, like, secluded towns.
Mm-hmm.
Having it come from Chicago, I think not too many records like that.
Yeah, and, I mean, well, Dance from Hoffman Estates.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was just, like, for me, it was just like the escape from self kind of thing, more than like escape from my town.
Yeah.
You know, specifically. I don't know if I could speak to the other guys. I think it
comes out in all of your songs, like, yeah, in some way, like, I got to get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, I think that it shows too that, like, this was a different city of Chicago than it has been in the years since, really, like, within the next, like, 4 or 5 years, you don't hear too many, like, negatives from,
yeah,
Chicago.
It's true. I never really considered it, but as we go through this, this definitely paints a picture of an old Chicago.
Yeah.
You know, of a city that is not here anymore. I mean, there's still parts of the city that are terrible, you know, but...
Well, I think that Uptown is, like, kind of one of those places that still has, like, a lot of the things that you're talking about on this,
yeah,
record with, like, dispossessed people. Anytime I'm, like, up for show at the Riviera or the Aragon.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is a... Uptown, for better or for worse, has maintained its integrity as Uptown.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for sure.
25 Degrees North, a great song about joining a band.
That's right.
Like all classic stories of the rock and roll journey.
Yeah, this song is pretty dumb. My friend Eric had just given away all his earthly possessions.
Is that Eric Bakowitz?
It is.
Yes! Another string, another thumbtack.
He had given away all his earthly possessions and gone to live on a 21-foot sailboat, which is not very long, if you consider,
yeah,
like, 6 of those feet would be where you sleep.
I'm already getting fucking anxious thinking about it.
And it was just pretty inspiring to me that he just, like, got rid of all his shit.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was sitting around playing in a band, it sort of seemed like I was not doing life in, like, the most adventurous way I possibly could.
Yeah.
You know, and that was sort of the sentiment for this song. I mean, the actual execution of it's pretty stupid. The song's not that good, but, you know, I know all about it.
Yeah. I love that it's like, you know, you start out about how you're joining the band, and it's like, no, that, it's actually a story about this guy, Brendan New, and how great he's doing. Oh, cool. I was, yeah, super invested in that part of the story. It's funny to me that you, like, point at the Gulf Coast, like a weirdly specific place to point your
Gold Coast resentment.
Oh, okay. That makes so much more sense. On the internet, it's Gulf Coast. And I was like, the people of Sarasota, the part of the problem thing?
That,
Gold Coast, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's really close to where you're at, right? If we could get into the Chicago geography for people outside the city.
Well, no, the Gold Coast is like east, right just north of like the Hancock
Division, yeah.
You know, and I live way up on Wilson.
Right. I always forget how far north that is.
And I live like this far west also.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I think you're even closer to the Gold Coast than I am here, but, you know, it's been a traditionally very wealthy Chicago neighborhood. And, I used to ride my skateboard down there a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
get right cheap. Now it's like a lot of boutiques, but then you see like these old houses that are like, you don't go much further north in the city when you're seeing actual like houses.
Yeah,
like that. It's like the earliest establishment of.
Yeah, and it's a lot of like 90-year-old lady smoking a cigarette in a fur coat, walking mm-hmm. a tiny dog, like that kind of thing. Like people that have just lived there forever and ever and ever. But yeah, it's a real, and it kind of butts against Cabrini Green a little bit, and so,
mm-hmm.
Which no longer exists, but that's like the, you know, what first municipally funded public housing project in America.
It's still like empty and weird.
Yeah, and so it's a good place if you're a young punk rock kid skateboarding around. Once you go through Cabrini Green and come out in the Gold Coast, it really highlights the human disparity that's surrounds you.
Yeah, I was working at a coffee shop in at like Clark and Fullerton, and this was like Occupy Wall Street time or something, and then this old lady who came in all the time, old money, was like, I don't know why people are like complaining so much about poor people. I don't see them. And I'm like, they're right fucking next to you. Are you kidding me?
Well, it's easy not to see something if you don't look for it.
All right. The Pope of Chilitown. Don't worry. Brandon's going to give us the dish on the cops. Dan didn't do a good enough job 10 songs earlier.
Well, first of all, you said there's not enough Simpsons on here, but the Pope of Chilitown is a Simpsons reference.
I was going to say, is that the food critic?
No, it's...
Or is that the, I'm sorry, the Johnny Cash episode?
Yeah, it is the Johnny Cash episode. But that's what Chief Wiggum says. Nah, that Simpson thinks he's the Pope of Chilitown.
We've got a Jenny Jones reference.
Oh, yeah.
So this is the 5 years of build for you to hit Pavichi and Voyeurs, your peak on the daytime talk show host lyrics.
Yeah, this is I was on the Jenny Jones show, just in the audience.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, I was there because all that stuff was filmed here. Springer and Jenny Jones and stuff.
Yeah, I was on Springer.
Yeah. In the audience?
Yeah,
or?
In the audience, yeah.
Nice.
It was my dad's Christmas present 1 year.
That's great. like his to you or yours to him?
Mine to him.
Terrific. Very good. Yeah, this is a... This one's actually not that stupid. It's not that smart, but... Like, I always forget about this one when this record comes around, but...
It's totally like a... It's a good song. This is, to me, an interesting point to just say, like, the fact that there are 15 songs on your record is wild to me.
Yeah.
Like, I thought about that for a second because nobody would do that within, like, a couple years, it felt like. Yet it just got trimmed down to 12. But you look back and it's like, well, Bad Religion has 15 songs on every record.
Well, 15 Bad Religion songs is, like, 20 minutes long, though.
Yeah, that's true.
So that's different. It's like on the new Lawrence Arms record, there's going to be 14 songs, but it's only like 30 minutes.
That is the smartest thing that you've said in a long time.
Yeah, well.
But yeah, this is kind of, I guess like when you're, like this is a record that, or this is a song that if I'm like, if I'm going through the editing process of this record, it's like, okay, like Dan did everything with the Police song right here. Like this one, we could just cut.
Just wheel it.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you can probably wheel most of my songs on this record. But
that's very true.
But, you know, what are you going to do? I do like the idea. The last line of the song, I think sentiment-wise, is a lot better than the entire rest of the song.
Mm-hmm.
But just like, you know, if you just keep watching Jenny Jones and you're fridge filled up with beer, you'll never even hear your neighbors scream until it's you. It's like then I saw right after this record came out the No Means No Jello Biafra, not a split, it's like he sings with No Means No, and it's called
cool.
The Last Scream of the Missing Neighbors, and I was like, no, what? But I, well, that's better.
Okay, so what do you remember the topic on your Jenny Jones episode that you went to?
I think it was Secret Crushes.
amazing.
Oh, that's the thing that you're talking.
Would say that. I gave a little bit of prep for Brennan to say I got some fucking Jenny Jones knowledge to drop, because she to me was kind of like Sally Jesse Raphael, where I remember that she was like on TV, but I don't really remember her in any like way. So I fell into a little YouTube hole last night to learn this story about Jenny Jones. So, daytime talk show host Jenny Jones on an episode called Secret Crushes that was taped on March 6th, 1995. Today is March 6th, 2020. It's the 25th anniversary of this event. A man named Scott Amador confessed his love for his friend Jonathan Schmitz. Now, Schmitz was straight and was under the impression that it was a female friend who was also on the show who was going to be confessing her love to him. Now, he's embarrassed on stage. 3 days after the show's taping, Schmitz killed Scott Amador. He was later convicted of second-degree murder. And then later, the family sued the producers of Jenny Jones. They had to pay him $25 million. Insane story.
Wow. $25 million sounds like some good money, though. I mean, not worth, like, losing a child over.
Yeah. Yeah, but I feel like when you really start to... Time heals all wounds, but also, like, yeah, this is kind of...
Yeah.
This is a nice car that we have now.
Probably buy another child.
So I watched the Dateline story on it, and it's insane, because Jenny Jones, like, just straight up refuses to acknowledge, like... Even the fact that this guy is humiliated on stage, like the least amount of culpability of, well, did Jonathan seem embarrassed by this story? And she's like, no, he didn't. It's just like, you can't even give that much.
She probably is not allowed to. Well, I mean, I guess it's over now. There's no double jeopardy or whatever.
It's great though. It's Dateline. It's so good at just like making people look so bad. So it's like this is everything you want to see. And then Dateline too. Later on down the line, they murdered somebody.
Well, everybody on TV has murdered somebody.
Where, but this is like this is, you want like the clowns were only here to entertain. Like talk about the people that they bring onto these shows.
Oh yeah.
Fucking gross.
Well, that's what I was saying about Maury Povich the other day. You know, it's so exploitative, and it's often very class based. And in the case of Maury specifically, it's also very race based. And it's just like, it's gnarly. I mean, like that entire era, I guess it still exists, right? Shit's still going on.
Yeah, I think it's like kind of turned into this weird thing where it's just like, it's more like Dr. Oz is just telling everybody like what to worry about with like the hand sanitizer that they've been using for 12 years now.
Yeah, but I think Maury still like does paternity tests and shit like that.
Yeah.
And there's like that Steve Wilkos show.
Yo, Steve Wilkos has had a show for like 20 years.
And it's
Isn't
crazy.
That fucking insane?
Yeah. For those of you who don't know, Steve Wilkos is the big tubby bald security guy from the Jerry Springer show. I'm sure you probably do. No, he's a lot less obscure than we are.
At this point, yeah, I just remember like when we went to Jerry Springer, there was like a, like, if you're asking questions, don't ask if you can rub Steve's head. Like, just like, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. So yeah, we got Nautical Mile, the last song on this record. And as you mentioned, Chris and Sean Nader on the lyrics. Sean Nader's a name that kind of bounces around a little bit. Can you like fill us in a little bit more on like, how did you all know Sean? Like, where does he fit into all of this?
Sean is, he's from Detroit, and he's played in bands in Detroit forever. We got to know him, I guess it was probably when his band Blanket was opening for 15 in Michigan, and we went out and saw them.
Mm-hmm.
I think Tricky Dick, which was Chris's old band,
dude,
played.
I listened to that Tricky Dick discography yesterday. Fucking, it's the best.
Wild, man. The, I think that Blanket and Tricky Dick played some shows together. But anyway, long story short, Nader moved to Chicago for school, and he went to Columbia with Chris, and they were roommates. The Lincoln House, which was above the, what was that place called? It was this like big game eating place. And it like looked like a lodge. It's on Lincoln Avenue. They lived above it, and you could like eat like,
and just smell bison all
you
day.
You could eat like bison and wolf or whatever. I don't know. You know, but but so Nader went there, and he was a fine art student, and he's done a lot of art for the Lawrence Arms over the years. And he's like the guy that kind of looks like a weird gay disco Uncle Fester on the back of We All Know You Can Do It 7-inch by the Broadways.
Lovely description.
Yeah, I mean, if you see the picture, it's pretty hard to describe him any other way. But so, yeah, Sean's just been a great buddy of ours forever. He lives in Detroit now with his wife. He's a amazing painter. And if you go to Sean Nader Art on Facebook, you can see all his paintings, and you can buy them, and he will send them to you, and they're awesome, and they're huge, and it's really, really cool.
Sean Nader Art on Facebook. I'm telling you, we're good at these ad reads. You know what? Actually, I think this is my favorite song on this record. It always goes like this: is I listen to 15 minutes and I'm like, oh fuck, that they never top this song, and then I listen to this record a few times and then it just all starts to click.
Yep. Well, yeah, this song is this is probably the greatest example of the meandering all over the placeness, and it's very interesting. I think there's parts in this song that kind of like sag, but then it just like kicks in at the end and it is cool.
Yeah.
Like, I think there's a kind of a long middle that if you're talking about editing things, I mean, you could, you could remove about 2 minutes from this song and I think it would only improve it. But
I mean, this is at that phase in like creativity where it's like, if you got a microphone, you got to say fucking everything. You have to put everything that you can out there.
Very, very much the case. I mean, like, the idea of editing wouldn't become something that I saw as valuable for a while still after this, you know?
I mean, I think even if there's like no competitiveness between the three of you, you're making all of your songs like, they have to matter, right? It's like for that moment, it's like, this is my song. It's not the other two. Like, I got a lot to say here, and I want to make sure that I say all of it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I mean, I think just what I was getting at, and I mean, also like at the time, even like writing longer songs was an interesting thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it like punk rock was a lot of short songs, and then it really. Song length was like really tied to artistic merit back then, I think.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and so I think we wanted to be like this like fucking dirty political punk band that would like make Simpsons references but also have long songs, you know, and therefore get like the critical acclaim that we so richly deserve, which never happened. But
well, the critical acclaim doesn't come, but I mean, definitely all those slapstick fans that were so stoked about your new record were also not there.
Yeah, sadly disappointed. Yeah.
So you have to be all of you are thinking like, this is fucking it, right? Is there any doubt?
No doubt. No doubt at all. That we're 100% on the rocket to Mars, and the record comes out, and nobody likes us. Nobody likes when we play live. We go on tour. We can't make any money. We're playing with a bunch of ska bands.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I told this story here or not, but we played a show at this place called the Coos Cafe in Santa Ana, California. A guy from Rhythm Collision put it on.
Who's that?
their band that was on Doctor Strange back in the 90s. It was like a little house. And so we were playing like sort of right next to the door. It was a little house that had been converted into a coffee shop.
Mm-hmm.
And so the door is right there. And this kid comes in and asks the doorman, he's like, where's the band that's ex-Slapstick? And the doorman goes, oh, it's these guys that are on stage right now. And the kid started to cry. So that's where we were at in this band.
Wow.
Yeah.
How old was this kid?
Too old for that shit. I mean, I don't know.
So any age over 11?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. That was the whole thing. This band was very hard to be in for that reason specifically, because we were under the impression that we were like giving you all gold, man. And then it's just like the sad truth reared its ugly head. We're like, oh no.
So when you say like nobody liked you in Chicago, like who were you playing with in Chicago? Was it kind of whoever's playing in the Fireside Bowl? Is it?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. I mean, we're just like, our first show ever was with the Suicide Machines at Metro.
That doesn't work.
Oh no, wait. We played out in Record Breakers.
Baby, Hoffman Estates.
Yeah. So
I have so many Lawrence Arms CDs that were purchased from that Record Breakers.
Yeah, man. Dan used to work there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
My friend Scott like lived right there, and he worked at the Walgreens, and he just spent all of his money at Record Breakers before he went home.
Yeah. But we played like a ton of like VFW shows and like all that kind of shit. And no, nothing worked.
Wow.
The Broadway was wildly unpopular. I can't remember like what our biggest show would be. Our best show, I think, if I recall, was in Toledo, Ohio. The crowd was there and it was a small room, so it seemed packed, and they kind of went nuts. And every once in a while, we'd have a kid, like we played a basement in Boise, Idaho. And these kids were like, you guys just changed my life forever. You know, like that kind of shit. Like we could be there 15 or whatever, the out of tune rambling band that, that changes your life. But yeah, for the most part, real fart in a spacesuit.
And it doesn't really take long, right? Are you still a band at the end of 1998?
I don't think so. We did a couple tours, and then it just like the sort of pressure of being in the band, I think, was too much for all of us. And I think we all kind of snapped in our own way.
Yeah, for sure. We'll get into a little bit more of the like lore stuff, I think, for the Broken Van episode. But as far as Broken Star goes now, like the heavy mythologizing of all of it and the way people have, you know, propped it back up. You play the Asian Man 15th anniversary, you play Riot Fest a couple years later. Like, what's it all like for you once this call for the Broadways like reaches a point where it's just like, all right, well, let's like fucking like play a couple shows?
I think that, you know, when we got together, the overwhelming thing was like, what the fuck? These are our songs? Okay. You know, yeah. And I think it's just, the whole thing is just kind of hilarious at this point. But I mean, you know, for a long time at Lawrence Arms shows early on, you could just tell who the worst person in the crowd is going to be is the guy wearing the Broadway shirt.
Yeah.
You know, like it's just like, oh, this fucking guy.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of whatever happened to the Broadways. Well, man, you never came to see us, so we broke up. You know, you and all your friends didn't like us then.
I think it's funny to look to, you know, we're just coming off Ghost Stories, and then we fast forward a couple years we fast forward a couple years from this record, and Ghost Stories and Single File both come out within a couple weeks of each other. And I think that all three of you really had by that point outshined what you were doing.
Oh yeah,
this record.
Yeah, that Single File record's amazing.
It's fucking It's so, so stellar.
That's my favorite thing Mike Parks ever put out of anything.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I still listen to that album.
Well, this was awesome. We're once again thrilled to have all y'all join for another episode of Road to the Skeleton Coast. And we're going to do another one next week. Brennan, what do you think we should talk about?
I think we should do maybe apathy and exhaustion. I feel like it's been swell talking about the Broadways, but I'd rather not do that next week.
I can talk about seeing the Porno and Snuff Films video on JBTV. And also, we can go back to Record Breakers when I bought this CD.
Ooh.
Looking forward to it.
Dizzying highs.
Reminder to all of you to rate and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher. Tell your friends. We're having a fun time doing this and we want everyone in on the party. So help us spread the word. And we'll be back next week with another edition of Road to the Skeleton Coast.
Later, y'all. See ya. Thanks.
Thanks, all the time.